Hey, Leela.
Hey, Hannah.
So, Leela, I have a question. Mm-hmm. Were you whooped as a child?
Whoopins. Yes, I was. In fact, mm-hmm. I have a aversion right now to fly swatters because that was sometimes used to give me a little smack on the thighs. Mm. Or those paddles, you know, those paddles with the ball on them and the elastic, you know?
Yes.
Those paddles, yeah. Those bouncy paddles. Yeah, I do remember. Every now and then, that paddle toy became something that I was afraid of. Mm. What about you? Were you spanked?
I wasn't whooped. My siblings were. Like, I saw that belt come out. But it was never for me. I got kind of like just like talking to, but I never got really spanked. I never got really whooped. But my brothers, they got that belt. Mm. They definitely got that belt. Mm-hmm. And people have been talking about how we should or shouldn't discipline our kids for a while. It's not a new conversation.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of thoughts and feelings about this, and debates over corporal punishment are definitely not new in Black communities.
It was the Thursday of a leap year. The air was crisp, the sky was blue, and the belt was black.
I don't want to hear anymore.
Not even about the color of my tears. They were red. Okay, don't be mean. He's scared. He should be. It's terrifying. I mean, not for me. I'm too old to be spanked. I've aged out.
Where'd you hear that, Junior?
Well, I mean, I'm 13 now. That means I'm out of the whooping window.
Yeah, but you still have an ass, don't you?
This episode of Blackish from 2014 talks about what we're saying. Now, the dad here is conflicted about using a belt to whoop his son. Now, the granddad, he's less conflicted.
An ass is an ass is an ass is an ass.
Here's a question. If I'm a parent, how do I know where the line is between that pop and abuse?
Mm-hmm. And is that pop considered abuse?
Mm-hmm. We gotta stoop this.
The stoop.
Stories from across the Black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl. Mm.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee anointed people.
When a Black woman walks up to the desk in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
Hello, hello, Malcolm Gladwell here. This season on Revisionist History, we're looking at the dreaded phrase that no one in Hollywood wants to hear. One that describes the purgatory where once promising scripts go to die. Development hell. I called up everyone I knew in Hollywood and asked them to pitch me a project that broke their heart because it never got made. These stories were so good, and you can hear some of them on Revisionist History. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Now, Leela, we need to get this out of the way. Some things on today's episode may be hard to hear, so we just have to let everybody know that. So this question about spanking, we sent our producer, Natalie Peart, to talk about it with some folks.
Yes, corporal punishment was a thing in our house, but you have to understand, we were some bad kids.
My mother, she had a kind of plastic hose of sorts. And when you saw her reach for that, you knew that it was over for your life.
I remember when I decided I was not going to use corporal punishment when I brought my daughter home from the hospital. And my best friend's mother, who's been a teacher for over 30 years, said to me, "You have a beautiful daughter. She's gonna give you a lot of trouble growing up, and you will have to discipline her, but you will never raise a hand to her."
What's up? How have you been? Welcome back to the Soulful Liberation Podcast, the space where we seek to empower youth with foster care experience and share the journey of breaking generational curses.
Lila, that last voice was Angela Quijada Banks. Mm-hmm. She's 25 years old and identifies as Afro-Indigenous.
My mom and my dad kind of had a very strenuous relationship.
Angela is the oldest of six. She was born in Anaheim, California. She lived with her mom at her grandma's house. Her mom was off and on with her dad. And when her dad would show up, there were a lot of arguments and a lot of fights and just stress. And she was right in the middle of all of it. Angela remembers when she was about five and she was just learning her ABCs.
My earliest memory was like writing my alphabet on a wall in a hotel room. I remember being really excited about it. And my mom was just not excited about it. Very angry. And I remember she just kind of like jacked me up. It wasn't a pop or a spanking. There wasn't just like a slap on the wrist, but definitely like taking the belt out, and the belt fell on all areas of my body. On top of that, she said, "Wait till your dad gets home." And then I remember like her holding me down on her lap, and then my dad proceeded to whip me. The only reason why I really stopped and I was squirming and stuff is because I had to use a bathroom. So I was just like, I have to pee.
I mean, you know, as a parent, if you're having a bad day and you come home to your kids writing all over the walls, you know, it can trigger a kind of fuse, maybe.
And Angela's case, what happened to her? I mean, this sounds like abuse.
Yeah. Well, so let's take a look at what the law says, because this kind of behavior from parents towards their children is treated differently depending on where you are. So there's this overall standard is you cannot cause physical harm to your child, right? But then you've got these different states having different definitions of what harm is.
California law states, serious physical harm does not include reasonable and age-appropriate spanking to the buttocks where there is no evidence of serious physical injury.
But Lila, then there's federal law.
In federal terms, physical abuse is generally defined as, quote, any non-accidental physical injury, unquote. That may include burning, kicking, biting, or striking a child.
Okay, striking a child, that's what was happening to Angela.
Mm-hmm. But then you see the word may, right? It's also tricky. And a lot of the time it's left to the discretion of local authorities as to whether or not something is considered abuse. And it's not just the legal circles. Pediatricians have been debating this thing, too. In 2018, the American Pediatrics Association changed their guidelines, and they became very clearly anti-spanking. But then, you know, some Black pediatricians were pushing back. They were saying, you know, it's going to take time to change whole communities and behaviors, and that it's Black families that are going to suffer the most from this new recommendation.
Yeah, they said it would lead to the vilifying of Black families. And there's this statistic that Black kids are put in foster care at higher rates than other racial groups. So it's complicated. But Hannah, what about Angela? What happened to her?
Well, like you said, what was happening to her was definitely more than the occasional whooping. Like this one time when Angela was 14 and her mom had left their home, the mom comes back angry and punches Angela in the face. Now, Angela's mom would periodically leave the kids for stretches of time and then come back. And there was this one time when she left, and when she got back, her outbursts became worse and worse. Angela's tipping point was after her 16th birthday.
Mentally, I was really struggling. And I had already, you know, started struggling at a very young age, but it got to the point where, like, I just wasn't really seeing the point of living. I was just seeing, like, this is way too much.
Hey, it's Hannah from The Stoop, and we wanted to tell you about a new collection from NPR. Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country we reflect. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Leela, hearing Angela's story, I know I've heard a lot of times people back home, people in my community talk about this idea of make sure you don't leave a mark. You know what I mean? Have you heard that before? Like when you smack your kid or when you hit your kid, make sure there's no visible mark. But actually, hitting does leave a mark.
Often I give the example of if you were walking in a forest and you saw a bear, right? Like how?
That's a good example for California.
Yes.
This is Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, and she's a pediatrician.
She's also California's Surgeon General. So you see a bear.
What happens is the part of your brain that's responsible for your fear response, your amygdala, when it's activated by something scary, it actually sends projections to the part of your brain that's responsible for judgment and executive functioning and impulse control. This is the prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. And it turns it way, way down.
Dr. Harris did this research, and she discovered what repeated abuse can do to the development of the brain.
Dr. Harris spent a lot of time working with families in Bayview Hunters Point. That's a Black neighborhood in San Francisco. And she was studying Black family trauma and how parents are disciplining their kids.
She tells us to think about this bear situation.
If you're in a forest and there's a bear, you don't want judgment getting in the way of survival, right? Mm-mm. And instead, what it does is it activates a part of the brain that's known as the noradrenergic nucleus of the locus coeruleus.
The what now?
I know. What'd she say?
The noradrenergic nucleus of the locus coeruleus, or as I like to call it, the part of the brain responsible for, I don't know karate, but I do know crazy. This is the within-the-brain stress response system, and it's responsible for getting us amped up, right? Mm-hmm. So that we are just, you know, brazen enough to fight this bear. But the problem is what happens when that bear comes home every night.
So, for example, for Angela, that repeated hitting from her parents was her proverbial bear, right? And that wasn't just affecting her emotionally, it was physically affecting her brain.
This system is activated over and over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it goes from being adaptive, right, or life-saving, to maladaptive or health-damaging. We become adapted to situations of high stress and trauma, right? Mm-hmm. So that amygdala alarm that warns us about fear, it becomes overactive.
And she says they can actually see this on an MRI, that kids who experienced a lot of adversity, their amygdala becomes larger.
The part of the brain where fear is processed.
And we begin to see danger in sometimes where danger doesn't exist, right? We begin to interpret behaviors as scary. So perhaps it isn't the, you know, abusive parent whose hand lands on your shoulder, but it's the next time a hand lands on your shoulder, even if it's your teacher trying to help you, tell you to pay attention in class, that activates your fight or flight response. And initially, that immediate reaction is to fight back.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
But Leela, there's this other conversation that Dr. Harris thinks we should be having here. And it's a conversation about the stressors of being Black in this country.
I mean, there's never any justification for any abuse, but there's one thing that Dr. Harris has noticed in her practice, and she's noticed this over and over again. And her research shows that many parents themselves experience being beaten and grew up in homes with unsafe experiences too.
It's not about playing the blame game and say you're an awful parent because your child was exposed to X, Y, Z, or because, you know, you hit your child, or because, you know, there was drug use happening in your home, right? What it is now is saying, we understand that these things are damaging to children's brains and bodies, and we can help you get the tools to break this intergenerational cycle.
So what are these tools?
We can do it by raising awareness, doing routine screening. Every pediatrician in America should be screening for adverse childhood experiences.
And so she says if our communities do all of this, then these intergenerational cycles of abuse may start to change and they may start to shift. Because she says in her experience,
I've met so many parents. I've met parents who even honestly have harmed their children. But I've never met a parent who didn't love their child.
The intergenerational cycle. Now, that's something really interesting that we should talk about, Hana. Many Black families will tell you, what I'm doing is not abuse. I'm disciplining my child. This is what I know. This is what I do. I was whooped all the time, and I turned out fine. You know, that's what people say.
Yeah, Leela, and I hear it too. I mean, I hear it so much in, like, Sudanese community, Arab communities, that all these communities I'm a part of, these immigrant circles, there's this idea that I should be able to whoop my child. I should be able to hit them, spank them if they're misbehaving, because it's my culture. It's how I was raised. Mm-hmm. I hear that a lot.
So what else are people saying? I'm curious. What else are you hearing?
So let's look at this immigrant perspective for a minute. There's this other side to this. Back home, you know, they're used to disciplining their kids however they want, like we said. But now they're in the U.S. And there are three numbers they have to think about.
911, what's your emergency?
They can call 911.
That's Dr. Adeyinka Akinsulure-Smith.
And I go by Yinka for short.
Okay, so Dr. Yinka is a professor of psychology at the City University of New York, and she's worked with a lot of families facing all kinds of trauma and a lot of young people who've been abused at home.
And Dr. Yinka is from Sierra Leone, so she knows exactly what we're talking about.
So, you know, it's this notion, you bring your child to America, right? You've been dreaming of America, you know, this wonderful place, you're going to get education. But you're used to dealing with your children back home. At least you know how you deal with them back home. You're used to disciplining them in a certain way. They get a spanking. They get a yelling. You know, there are a number of ways that can be physical punishment. It can be hitting.
For Dr. Yinka, this issue was so important to her that she co-authored a study about it.
Uh-huh. Let me guess. Was it called 911 Among West African Immigrants in New York City? A qualitative study of parents' disciplinary practices and their perceptions of child welfare authorities?
Yes, literally.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked to 59 West African immigrants, 32 parents, and 27 teenagers. And she says for African immigrants, it's been a tough issue to navigate.
Now, these parents suddenly realizing that if you do certain things, not only does your child have the right to call 911, which is a boogie, you know, person, there are other people watching. So there is the school system that you have to be concerned with. This fear that your child would be taken away from you all came to the forefront of what parents said.
And these concerns, they didn't come from just fear alone. They were based out of facts, like what these immigrant families have seen and what Dr. Yinka has heard, like with this one family in New York.
This was an African family. There were some issues, behavioral problems. The kid was, you know, what we would say in the parlance, acting up, you know, being disobedient, not listening, going and coming as they please. The parent moved to discipline, giving a spanking, and the child called. And not only was that child, but other children in the household were taken away. And so then the parent is left with, what do I do? How do I get my kids back?
And this change in the parent-child power dynamic, it's really, really shocking to immigrant parents. They're not used to a world where the child has any authority over their own mom and dad. And Dr. Yinka says there's this term for those kids.
I'm roughly translating from my lingua franca Creole to English, but it's children made here versus children made there. You know, the child that you have here, they're different than the child you may bring from back home. And they learn that they have rights. You know, not that our kids back home don't have rights, but rights are a little different. And when you don't speak the language or you don't speak the language well, you are afraid because of your status. You don't have papers or you're waiting for papers. You don't want to bring attention to yourself.
Dr. Yinka herself says something that I've heard other parents say as well.
If I could just send you back home.
And that threat, that threat gets those kids together real fast. Because I know people who did that. I know folks who sent their kids back to Sudan because they couldn't handle them here.
So they get sent back home with this idea that they'll be disciplined.
I mean, supposedly the way they want them to be disciplined, right? It absolutely happens. And it's a true threat and it works.
Do you tell your children that, Hannah?
Mm-mm. I don't. But I've heard it. See, Lila's trying to catch me.
I'm just saying, do you tell your children that you're going to send them back home?
I don't know. That is definitely not a threat that I use. I would not send them back. But I know a lot of people who have, you know, people dealing with just difficult situations and just couldn't handle it. Mm-hmm. So they send them back to the grandmother, the auntie, the uncle, whoever.
It's a conversation. It's not the way we're out to get you and take your children away, but it's about making sure that the children are safe. You know, that there are many other ways to show how much you love your child.
So, Hannah, what Dr. Yinka was saying about 911, I mean, there's a lot of people who have that instinct to call 911 because you think that's your protection, you know, when you're in danger. But we all know that calling 911 has not been the best solution, especially for Black people in this country.
Yeah, but we also have to acknowledge that in some cases, those whoopings become excessive. They become beatings and it becomes abuse. And that child ends up needing help. Like Angela. In her case, she was being beaten. Plus, because of her parents' instability, she and her siblings ended up living in a motel. And remember, she was feeling like she didn't want to live. So she did something about it. Let's go back to her story. We last left her in high school. She liked school a lot. She loved science. But things were getting worse at home, so she internalized it.
Around that time, I ended up becoming mute. I was sent to the counselor's office multiple times, specifically because of how I was in class. And I also did this thing where I would just periodically, abruptly cry randomly throughout class or at the end of class. And so that became an alarm for teachers. And they were like, you got to go to the counselor's office.
And for Angela, it was hard to tell her counselors what was happening at home.
Well, at first I wasn't talking to them, but after a while, maybe a couple of months, I started talking to them.
On the one hand, she was the oldest sibling and she wanted to do right by her other five siblings. On the other hand, she didn't want to add to their misery and she didn't know what would happen. It was hard. And she and her siblings were all scared. But her counselors started to help her see that there were options.
They started letting me know that there were solutions to my problem. And my sibling's problem, my family's problem. There were a lot of solutions. It's just whether or not I was serious about wanting that solution.
So one day, she chose a solution. She told her counselors about what was going on. And soon after that, Child Protective Services came to their hotel.
Someone came by the hotel and looked at, you know, the conditions, as well as asked us, you know, what were we eating and how we were treated.
After that, they took custody of all the kids.
They separated us by gender. And so me and my sister were placed together. And then my brothers were placed together. And that was so hard for me because I was like a mother figure to them for so long. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm not. And I'm, you know, having to just, I don't know, try to focus on surviving the situation.
Angela got out of foster care when she was 18. She went to North Carolina State. She was studying for a degree in political science. So she was working, she was making money, and just trying to make a life for herself. Throughout this time, she wasn't communicating with her mom or dad. When she turned 19, she started looking for her dad and found him. They reconnected, they got on the phone, and when they talked, she and her father talked about what happened when they went into foster care.
He was very angry, but anger is a secondary emotion, so I think hurt.
And now that Angela was an adult, she was able to ask her father all the questions she had on her mind.
Why did you do this? What, like, why did you think it was okay? He definitely takes ownership and, you know, has apologized.
And Lila, even with everything she's been through, Angela says we can't talk about any of this without talking about where it all may have come from.
It didn't start with him. That was the way he was disciplined. You know, his father, it goes down the line. And actually, when you go really far back, it goes back to slavery and how that was the way certain things were dealt with. Because as people of color, we weren't even seen as human beings. It also was liberating for me because instead of seeing myself as a victim of these terrible situations, you know, I don't see myself as a victim. I just see myself as like, I went through those horrible things. I see where they came from. I understand, you know, what I can do now with that information and helping others.
And, you know, when we talk about changing cultures, changing our perception of discipline and what it is, and not doing to our kids what our parents did to us or what their parents did to them, that's really captured in Angela's relationship with her dad. Angela is giving her father what her father didn't give her as a kid: compassion.
At the end of the day, you always have a choice to create something absolutely incredible and that is way bigger than what you could ever imagine. You get to decide the ending and you get to decide the people that surround you moving forward.
Today, Angela is a life coach and an author. She wrote a book called The Black Foster Youth Handbook. And she does have a relationship with her dad.
And that's The Stoop. The Stoop is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts.
The Stoop family includes editor Megan Tan, engineer James Rollins, producer Natalie Peart, art by Nima Iyer, music by Daoud Anthony.
Support for The Stoop comes from Cal Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org. And special thanks to the NPR Story Lab.
Bye.
Hey, it's Hannah from The Stoop. We're excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a new season. Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have been recently spending time at four California prisons and have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships in prison, and incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. Stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.